This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, jobs for all.
But first,
money for jobs, not for war. We go to the New York City Times Square demonstration on the evening after President Obama's speech escalating the war on Afghanistan.
This war will drag our country down. Right here in this city, we have a 50% unemployment rate of African American men. Despicable. Right here in this country, we have 49 million Americans who have a hunger problem. This is not tolerable, people. We have millions of people out evicted from their homes. We have people living in tents. Every dollar that we have should go to helping our own poor, our own working class. We have paid billions of dollars to the Wall Street fat cats to prevent this system from falling down. But we are getting left out in the cold. The only alternative for poor people's children is to go to war. Whether or not Obama's a great person, and we love him, is not going to decide the fate of war. Our children are going to go there. We already have 30,000 maimed. I'm begging you, send a message to President Obama. Send a message to all your so-called leaders. Send a message to your trade unions. Send a message. Get out of Iraq and Afghanistan. Use the money for the people here. We're not in any shape to go around building up someone's country so some slime bucket like Karzai can get a little richer.
Darryl, what brings you out tonight?
I'm here to protest President Obama's decision to send 30,000 troops to Afghanistan. There are so many people who are out of work, who are starving, who are on the streets here in the U.S. People are looking for work. People are struggling to make ends meet. I think that we need to focus on helping the people here in the U.S. who are like homeless folks, low-income families. With this huge bailout that, you know, just recently happened with the banks, I feel like our priorities are just misplaced. With the amount of money that we're spending on this war in Afghanistan, we could be helping people here.
What do you think it's going to do to the people in Afghanistan?
From all of the reports that I hear from different alternative news sources, it seems like our presence in Afghanistan isn't helping them. I feel like a lot of the deaths or civilian deaths are the result of U.S. attacks. Afghanistan historically has been an unwinnable country, and I'm not necessarily sure that sending more troops. At the end of the day, this is just about the oil pipeline that is running through Afghanistan. I don't think it has anything to do with Al-Qaeda, which from what I've been hearing is they're more centered in Pakistan.
Keep up the fight. Thanks a lot.
Troops out now! 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 Troops out now!
The main reason we're here today is dealing with this series of wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan. When the President of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, makes these speeches about a war against terror, the fact is that the number one purveyor of terrorism in the world today is the United States of America. More people are being killed from the Pentagon than any other agency in the world today. Over a million Iraqis have died since Gulf War I. Thousands upon thousands of people of Afghanistan have been killed, mostly civilians. Many people in Pakistan have been killed. Everywhere where the United States sets its feet at, this country remains poor and not wealthy. Power to the people!
Why are you against the war?
I'm just here supporting all my brothers that are over in Afghanistan. I know that a lot of them are getting extended in deployment due to Obama's decision, and it's just really upsetting. So I'm here to speak out because I promise never to complain about anything that I'm not willing to work for. So I'm trying to send a message to Obama.
Your brother's in Afghanistan right now?
Yes.
So what does he say? Have you talked to him?
Yeah, he thinks it's a big waste of time. He says that they have no purpose there whatsoever. So he's just watching a lot of people die. He's been deployed since June, and since June they've had 6 casualties. So he's very sad. And he just got word that he was supposed to come home, I think, in May, and they just said that it will be extended 3 to 6 more months.
Are you scared for him that he may not come home?
Of course, think about it every day.
And what about him? Does he feel that more troops will make the difference?
Absolutely not. He thinks this is a big waste of time, and he's scared to death that he's going to die. I'm just very disappointed in Obama's decision.
And so we are. Thank you very much. What's your name, please?
Noel.
Okay, Noel, thank you.
We're not going to stop until the U.S. war in Afghanistan, the U.S. war in Iraq is over, until we have jobs and housing and education instead of war. This sister made this sign, which I got to show you. It says no, no, and 30,000 times no. That's as many times as we're going to march. We're going to ask Larry Hales to close out this rally. And with you, like Larry Hales, we know that we're going to be victorious.
Thank you. This wasn't a long rally. It's a very long struggle. And we should be prepared for longer rallies. And for the police, the NYPD, who are telling people you have to be inside barricades. Today we're inside barricades, but tomorrow's a different question, because we have a right to be on the streets and to take the sidewalks. We're not worried about impeding traffic, not when bombs are falling on Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Pakistan, and all over the world. The hell with impeding traffic. As a matter of fact, we need more people so we can shut down all of Times Square. And that should be our next goal, is we should shut down Times Square. Just like our brothers and sisters in the immigrant rights movement when they shut down the country. Nothing moved. Without us, this society does not move. And that's what we have to do. Shut it down. Come out to the next rallies. Tell your friends, your neighbors, your co-workers. Get your unions to endorse. And we will stop the war. We'll shut Times Square down. We'll shut New York down. We'll win the struggle for jobs, the struggle for education, and for health care. We'll win the struggle against the war in Iraq and the U.S. support for rightist regimes around the world. All power to the people. Thank you for coming out.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we looked swell. Full of that Yankee doodle-dee-dum.
Aminata Maseka, Abby Lincoln with the Yip Haro Buddy, Can You Spare a Dime? Too applicable to today.
Well, the stock market is recovering. The official national unemployment rate exceeded 10%, and the real rate, which includes underemployment and discouraged workers, is at 17.5%. Economist Robert Pollan argues that this crisis demands a jobs program. Now,
We need to shrink the military and fossil fuel-based economy and shift resources to programs that create more jobs for each dollar we spend, such as health, education, social services, and green jobs.
Indeed, we do. These are also expenditures for things we need, unlike war and pollution. This jobs program would be paid for by savings from a reduced military budget and a national stock and securities transfer tax. Now, Robert Paulin, professor of economics and co-director at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, as he spoke at the Jobs for All conference in New York City.
The crisis today. Financial markets seem to be recovering very smartly. We've heard about the returns to Goldman Sachs. We've heard the projections that the bonuses and compensation for the year 2009 are, according to the Wall Street Journal now, are on track to exceed 2007, much less 2008, the dip year, the last year of recovery. At the same time, the official unemployment rate was 10%. That greatly understates the actual levels of labor market distress. The Labor Department itself recognizes that and puts out another set of statistics that includes people who are underemployed. If you work a job that you're working 1, 2, 3 hours a week and you want full-time, you are not counted officially as unemployed. You are counted as underemployed. So we conclude the underemployed, and we can include so-called discouraged workers, people that have been looking for a job but didn't look only for the last 4 weeks. If you put those two in, the official measure is 17%. And that number is unprecedented. So we are in a severe economic crisis. Beyond the well-being of a worker and her or his family, people that are employed also have money to spend. That means that market conditions are buoyant. Private businesses are willing to invest. When people do not have money to spend, private businesses will not invest. And that's when you hit a business cycle downturn, a recession. Finally, people who have jobs pay taxes. This is quite relevant to the discussion around the deficit. There are issues around how big the deficit can get, but we have to remember that to a very considerable extent, deficit financing pays for itself in as much as it means more people have jobs. Because when more people have jobs, then more people are paying taxes. Unemployment, of course, also pits workers against workers. When you have mass unemployment, people that have jobs are looking over their shoulder and afraid that the people that don't have jobs are going to accept their positions at lower wages. That weakens workers' bargaining power, and they have to fight among each other to obtain this most basic thing, a job. The notion of a full employment economy emerged in the 1930s as the moral centerpiece of economic policy throughout the world. We know the devastation that was caused by mass unemployment, that it created the grounds for the emergence of fascism in Europe, mass unemployment. And coming out of that condition of severe economic crisis, unemployment rates 25-30%, the idea starts to begin that government policy needs to be focused around the idea of creating decent employment for all. It's very important to recognize how important the notion of decent employment was. It was in 1938 that the first minimum wage law was passed. In the depths of the 1930s recession, instead of saying that the problem with the Depression was that workers' wages are too high, that we need to cut wages in order for businesses to be willing to hire, you actually had the initiative stating exactly the opposite thing. That in order to rebuild a decent, healthy economy, we had to create jobs, and the jobs had to pay decently. You need public investments for two things. You need to start enhancing the level of productivity that public investments in roads, bridges, rail systems create. But we also need, at this point, to make a transition to a clean energy economy, and we need public investments to achieve that. Public investments also counteract the instability of private investments. They're more stable. They're coming out of the stream of funding guaranteed by the government. Now, today, or as of 2007, the average wage for a non-supervisory worker was $17.42. So that's about 12% less than the average worker earned in 1972, 37 years ago. And these are for the people who are employed. This isn't even looking at the unemployed. The conditions have continued to worsen. Wages have stagnated or declined. Now, the average non-supervisory worker produces a basket of goods and services worth 90% more than they did in 1972. In exchange for that 90% improvement in productivity, the average worker takes a 12% pay cut. This is before the crisis. So we need to return to policies to put these ideas into practice. I want to just give you a few ideas. What do we do? Number one, we need to shift the priorities in investment spending in our economy. We need to shift out of militarism and out of fossil fuels. And we need to do both of those things because they are important intrinsically. We need to fight for a more peaceful society. We need to get out of Afghanistan and Iraq. And we need to defeat climate change. There are intrinsic benefits. We would want to do all of those things, even if it weren't good for employment. But it turns out that they are very powerful tools to promote employment. Investing in the social sectors of the economy, education, health, childcare, elder care, investing in clean energy, generates far more jobs per dollar of expenditure than putting money into the military, putting money into fossil fuels, and allowing Wall Street to speculate unregulated with our monies. Basically what we calculated, my co-authors and I at UMass, at Perry Political Economy Research Institute, we just calculated the total number of jobs created per $1 billion of spending in different sectors in the economy. Spending on fossil fuels is the absolute least effective source of job creation. So the fact that we are burdened by this fossil fuel energy infrastructure is horrible for the environment. It is equally bad for employment. It creates 5,300 jobs per $1 billion in spending. By contrast, clean energy creates 17,100 jobs. So 3.5 times more jobs. These numbers are no longer in dispute. I've gotten every brick thrown at me from right-wing groups. The Heritage Foundation has written 3 attacks. They're all on the web. I've answered them each and every time. The numbers are not in dispute. These are right. Just a couple other examples. Military spending is 11,600 jobs per billion. Contrast that with education, 27,400. Healthcare, 19,600. If you want to have an economy with high employment opportunities, you shift out of militarism, you shift out of fossil fuels, and you put the money into social sectors, health and education, and you put the money into clean energy. Next, job quality. One of the critiques that's often made is, sure, take the money out of the military sector, take it out of fossil fuels, you'll create a lot of lousy jobs. You're going to take away all the good jobs that are available for people in the Pentagon, allied fields, like working for Blackwater is a great job, as long as you can stay alive, and in working for an oil company. I've looked at these numbers as well. Now, here's the trick. You're creating 3 times, 4 times more jobs, and you are creating a lot more low-paying jobs. You're also creating a lot more high-paying jobs. If you create 3 or 4 times more jobs per a given dollar of spending, you're going to create more jobs across the board. So it's simply false to say that if you shift out of militarism and you shift out of fossil fuels, you're going to shift into an economy dominated by lower job opportunities, bad jobs. I want to also say one word about the so-called bad job. Many of us here have fought for living wages. There's no reason why there should be any bad jobs. All the jobs should be living wage jobs. Yeah. One of the things we did in our analysis was say, okay, we know that all jobs are not living wage jobs. Let's look at the ones, even the low-paying jobs, that have decent job ladders, right? And those are mostly in manufacturing and in construction. And we realized that a lot of those job ladders still are also embedded with racial and gender discrimination, and we need to fight those things. And in fact, we've been at meetings at the Labor Department about that. We know that at least the Labor Secretary is very concerned about that. But even a very high percentage, roughly half of even the bad jobs that are created by shifting spending into the social sector and into clean energy. Half of those have good job ladders, which is much, much higher, like four times higher than would be the case in fossil fuels. So as a simple exercise, what we said is, what if we just took 25% of the money now in the military and now in the fossil fuel sector? What would just that shift mean for jobs? Now, you would say, oh, that's so far-fetched, it's not worth even talking about. But Barney Frank, who's a member of Congress, has proposed a 25% cut in the military. I also want to point out that if we cut today's military budget by 25%, the level of military spending as a share of the economy would still be higher than it was in the year 2000, because we've had such a huge buildup due to Iraq and Afghanistan. And remember, Barack Obama campaigned on the promise of ending the war in Iraq, which cost us $150 billion. So it is not a far-fetched idea. And if we're going to do anything to seriously confront global climate change, we have to move out of fossil fuels, and we can do that very quickly. So in the short term, we can do things right now that will expand jobs and move both a social agenda and a clean energy agenda forward. And I'll just give a couple quick examples. Number one, retrofitting buildings is something that can be done easily. The technology is known. It's not fancy. Weatherizing homes, for example. We have 2 million construction workers in this country unemployed that have lost their jobs in the last 2 years. These people can be mobilized and we can retrofit. I've calculated that there's roughly $800 billion worth of retrofits that can be done in all the structures in our economy today. And those structures consume about 40% of all the fossil fuel energy. This can be done now. It should be done now. There are features of the Obama stimulus program that do bend on this and encourage this, but the action is not moved fast enough. I know that for a fact because I actually happen to be doing a bit of consulting with the Energy Department on implementing these programs, and they need to get going faster. And the way to start them is to have the government retrofit all of its buildings now. So you save energy, you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, you employ millions of people. Second, what about doubling the number of buses on the street? And what about telling the auto companies that, you know, if you want to expand your markets, how about converting part of your line to produce clean buses? And the government will procure them. We'll guarantee you a market. Just like we guarantee a market, we guaranteed a market for the internet for 40 years, and that's how the internet became commercialized, through the Pentagon. That's true. Third, education. I know from my own institution that we were facing $50 million budget cut last year. The stimulus money came and we didn't have to cut any jobs. Now, what they're telling us, okay, that was for good for 1 year, but now we're going to have to do the cuts. So we have to insist on no cuts in education. No layoffs, no cuts, fund education, at least at its current level. Those things would constitute a major stimulus program. And in the long run, these investments in clean energy and education also create employment opportunities, enhance productivity, and break our dependence on foreign oil and on fossil fuel oil. Where do we find the money for all this? Well, at least to a considerable degree, deficit spending pays for itself by giving people employment and the employed people pay taxes. Secondly, shifting money out of the military and out of fossil fuels does not require more money. It just requires a shift. If you shift, you create more jobs by not doing the thing that has low employment to doing the things that has employment. That said, we do need to find funds at the same time. And the first way, I say, is that we impose a tax on Wall Street trading. Even Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of Great Britain, supports this now. He advocated it just last week. Took him a long time, but he got there. Now, of course, the U.S. Treasury has already shot down the idea and says it's impractical, you can't do it. That's not true. You can do it. It's easy to do. So we have a speculation tax. So if people want to buy securities and hold them, they only pay the tax once. But if they want to go into the gambling casino, they should pay taxes just like people that go to Las Vegas or go to Atlantic City to gamble. You pay the tax. You can generate, according to some calculations I've done, you can generate in the range of $175 billion a year, even on a tax of 0.5% on stocks, and then scale downward on bonds and derivatives. Then on top of that, yes, we need to cut the military budget, and we need to establish some semblance of a reasonable healthcare system. We pay 17% of our GDP for healthcare. So that's almost one-fifth of the whole economy is on healthcare. That is double all the other, on average, advanced economies in the world. And we're getting outcomes that are worse. So basically that means that the health insurance business is squeezing $1 trillion out of our pockets without delivering better health care. We don't know what the outcome of the debate is going to be yet on health care, but whatever happens this go-round, we need to keep advancing it further. And I was really surprised, for whatever reason, Yale Medical School invited me to come speak on this issue, and I'm not really an expert on economics of healthcare, but okay, fine. So they invited me, and I said, okay, Yale Medical School. Well, it turns out that 75% of the faculty and 75% of the medical students support not a public option, single payer, 75% at Yale Medical School, including the dean. So we have an agenda, we have a program. It's a matter of bringing it forward. When medical scientists lack a cure for an epidemic disease, research funds are provided. But when faced with unemployment, some economists, governments, and the corporate interests they often reflect proclaim it cannot be cured, or that it does not exist, or it is, quote, natural. We know them to be wrong. So thank you very much.
And you are listening to Robert Pollan, Professor of Economics and Co-Director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts. And we heard Kent's favorite, the stock transfer tax.
And securities and derivatives. National tax. This is really important.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.